Welcome to Golau, where we shed some light on politics, policy and polling in Wales and the world.
Good morning, everybody. First, can I thank the Wales Governance Centre for hosting the launch today of our policy paper on Brexit and devolution. There's no time to waste. Today is our contribution as a government, and I look forward to hearing the views of others.
On the 15th of June 2017, the First Minister of Wales, Carwyn Jones, launched the Welsh Government's new policy paper, Brexit and Devolution, at the Cardiff University Business School Postgraduate Centre. You can catch up with the First Minister's statement about the policy document in our previous episode of Golau. See the link in the show notes. In this episode, we catch up with Professor Roger Scully, Dr. Rachel Minto and Dr. Joe Hunt, immediately after the First Minister's presentation and the Q&A session, to hear what they think about what the First Minister had to say. Thank you very much. As you can hear, we've just finished at the First Minister's briefing event for his new policy document about Brexit, Brexit and devolution. We're joined by Professor Roger Scully. Roger, what would you say your takeaway from this morning's briefing is?
I think the major thing is that after the general election results last week, we're now in a rather different political environment, and the Welsh Government are attempting to influence the debates that go on. You know, we were expecting before the election Theresa May to emerge with a big majority to pursue the sort of hardish Brexit that she seemed to be edging towards. Now, of course, the UK government has no parliamentary majority. Theresa May is having to sort of look for friends. And the Welsh government finds itself in a position where it's seeking to influence the debate at a time when, you know, things seem to be up for consideration again. So, you know, the Welsh government is pushing forward its views on single market access and on restructuring the UK around Brexit issues. And I think, you know, they seem to, perhaps more by luck than judgment, arrived at the perfect time to be doing so.
One of the questions that was raised by the audience here was that the question about how much support the First Minister's and the Welsh Government's position has across the rest of the UK. What did you think of his response?
We know that the UK government, Whitehall, is rather cautious, or has been thus far, about ideas of fundamentally restructuring the UK to introduce shared governance in the forms that the First Minister was talking about today. What he did stress, though, is that although, for instance, you know, the SNP government in Scotland, at least the Sinn Féin element of the Northern Ireland executive, you know, don't in a fundamental sense believe in the UK for the long term, they might be willing to work with the Welsh government in supporting some of these ideas, at least for the period while, you know, they see their territories remaining in the UK. So I think he was reasonably optimistic about the possibility of getting support from elsewhere in the UK. I think the subtext was that, you know, the principal problems lie in London, not in the other capitals.
He made great play about new structures being needed in order for the UK to function as well as it could do after Brexit. What did you think about the proposals that he was talking about, specifically replacing the JMC or maybe an additional body to the JMC to allow better intergovernmental working in the UK?
Well, the First Minister and the Welsh Government in this new document are proposing some pretty fundamental restructuring of the United Kingdom. They're proposing the introduction for the first time of genuine shared rule, where elements of, you know, power would be shared between the different governments of the UK. The UK government would not be in a position to dictate to the other governments what can happen in some areas. He's proposing essentially the abolition, more or less, of the idea of parliamentary sovereignty. You know, this is really radical stuff. And, you know, to some degree, this follows on from the sorts of things the First Minister, at least, has been saying for a while. But to see, you know, the whole of the Welsh Government very much putting themselves behind this, to have seen in the election campaign the Labour Party manifesto committing the party across the UK to supporting much of this, I think is very interesting and very important.
His position has been fairly consistent ever since the Brexit referendum in 2016. He seemed to be quite combative and ready to defend it, and he even went as far as to say that he will resist UK government imposition of new structures after Brexit.
I mean, quite what Welsh government resistance to UK imposition would mean, we don't know. But I think generally since the Brexit referendum, not least because Wales voted for Brexit and that rather undermined the bargaining position of the Welsh government, you know, Wales has been in a fairly weak bargaining position. Both Scotland and Northern Ireland have been effectively able to say to London, look, we didn't vote for Brexit, And if you push this through in a form which we don't like, we can make life difficult for you. We can make things happen that you don't want to happen. Wales hasn't been in that position. I think lots of people have felt it's largely been ignored. But now, post-general election, you know, lots of things seem to be in flux. There's a possibility maybe for Wales to reinsert itself into the debate. The sorts of things that the First Minister is proposing about the UK and about devolution are quite radical. He's been saying things like this for quite a long time. For much of that period, he hasn't even been able to carry the rest of his party with him. But now he seems to have brought much of Welsh Labour and indeed much of the UK Labour Party behind him. And after the general election result that we had in Wales, with, you know, the First Minister very much having been the lead of the Welsh Labour campaign, I think he is a much strengthened figure within his party. The overall election result also potentially allows him and Wales to try and influence the UK-wide debate in a more fundamental way than they've been able to so far. So, you know, in a sense, some of these points are points he's been making before. He's having another go at them, but maybe in a context in which he has more of a chance to actually make them hit home.
Thank you, Professor Scully. And now we have the opportunity to catch up with Jo Hunt and Dr. Rachel Minto of the Wales Governance Centre at Cardiff University to give their thoughts about the content of this paper.
For me, what I thought was particularly interesting was the proposal of a Council of Ministers to replace the Joint Ministerial Committee. So this is, how is the UK going to, as a union of four nations, going to organise itself post-Brexit when it comes to creating those supposedly commonly created frameworks that are going to replace those EU frameworks? So what the Welsh Government is proposing is that we move from a JMC, which is more like a talking shop, to a Council of Ministers that is actually a decision-making body. So you have these four nations within the UK coming together to make decisions about these common frameworks that will be agreed ideally through a consensus-seeking approach. If not, the initial proposal is to do this through a UK plus one government in order to agree these common frameworks.
Is there any conflict there if the UK government is acting on behalf of England and you're talking about a UK government plus one, which is essentially England plus one?
Mm-hmm. This is an outstanding question. I think this engages with ongoing debates within the UK government, within England, about how it will be governed as part of the UK. And it's not something that this paper engages with in any detail. However, I think what's notable is the shift between the ways in which the four nations deal with each other in the JMC, which is very hierarchical. You have, it's a consultative body, and you have the UK making the decisions, shifting it towards this more consensus-seeking, decision-making body.
Almost a European Union-style body.
Well, it has certainly been inspired by the Council of Ministers, or the EU Council in the European Union. And also they're asking for a standing secretariat, and also that the decisions that are reached through this body are overseen by an independent body. So this could be the Supreme Court, or it could be another body.
Absolutely, and I think reading through the document, you know, anyone with any knowledge or understanding of EU matters will see things that will jump out, things, terms and ideas and concepts that we are familiar with from an EU perspective. So we talk about pooling of sovereignty, the institutions of a council of ministers, and also the idea of an internal market that's been so central to the EU's existence. In the UK, we have an internal market mainly because the EU has done that work for us. Now, with the EU gone, taking that away, what's going to happen domestically, internally, if we have got sort of scope for different rules to be taken by Wales, by Scotland, by England, then potentially we're going to have different regulations, and that might be problematic for an internal market. Different rules create greater costs, create barriers to trade, and so that's part of this issue of how do we work together, how do we respect devolution, subsidiarity, and yet at the same time, how do we work together as part of a larger union? So the questions that are being raised here are ones that we've sort of lived through over decades with the European Union.
One of the things that he raised, that they might pass a bill, a continuity bill in the Assembly, which he framed as a defence against the UK government imposing new structures and new settlements on the devolved nations. How robust do you think that is?
Ultimately, we work within a system that has Westminster sovereignty as its primary norm. Now, under some understandings of it, that is, of that our constitution is a thing in development, it's a thing in evolution, and that idea, that commitment to Westminster sovereignty, Westminster parliamentary sovereignty, may not be commonly shared by all parts of the United Kingdom and all voices within the United Kingdom. And so, to some extent, we have to wait and see how robust that is, because ultimately, it would appear that a future Act of Parliament could simply wipe that away. And that is the concern. That's what the Welsh Government would be seeking to stand against. So it's more a sort of a political salvo. It's sort of a position that's being taken and a debate that could then come from that. And you know, each side would have to make its position clear. Now, ultimately, sort of the ultimate power may rest with Westminster under a sort of a pure constitutional theory of this. But there's, you know, we'd wait to see how that played out.
It was fascinating to hear the First Minister describe or outline what he considered the end of the era for parliamentary sovereignty. I wonder how widely shared that view is.
I think it's a view that has some strength amongst some areas of the UK and amongst some political actors within the UK system. I think it's fair to say that the Prime Minister would not share that view. I think that we've seen throughout this process an approach that the Prime Minister, the UK government, has taken that has definitely sort of been more in line with a sort of a unitary Westminster sovereignty approach to the UK.
The First Minister finished with a comment about his expectation that no deal can be reached between now and the spring of 2019. Would you concur?
Well, he was referring specifically to the future deal, the future relationship between the UK and the European Union. So we've got to remember there are going to be two sets of negotiations. So we have the Article 50 negotiations, so moving from an EU 28 to an EU 27. So this is the process by which the UK leaves the European Union. This will have to be finalised by the end of that two-year deadline, so the end of March 2019. But the creation of this, the future relationship, and what Theresa May has asked for in her Article 50 letter is a comprehensive free trade deal, a more comprehensive free trade deal than we've ever seen previously. This will take time to negotiate. So what's going to be important is to figure out what those transitional arrangements will be as the UK and the EU segue from this relationship onto whatever their future relationship will be. That is, obviously, if an agreement is reached and if the UK doesn't actually leave the European Union without a deal.
So is there a suggestion here that the UK government has to conduct three different levels of discussion at the same time? There's the Article 50 discussions, there's the future trading agreement with the EU discussion, but also the UK four nation internal arrangement discussion. So it's negotiating.
And it's probably even more, because if it's looking to the future outside a European Union, then any international trading relations beyond the EU. So there'll be the sort of the international level discussions with countries outside the European Union. So there are multiple levels, multiple dimensions to all of this.
Absolutely. And I would add on to this, and that's a really important point, is that, yes, we've got the UK's future relationship with the European Union, but we have to remember that Wales does have its own representation in Brussels. It has its own European presence, both within the institutional architecture of the EU, which it will lose, but it also has its outpost from which it works to establish networks and partnerships and with both regional and member state actors. So the Welsh Government as well and other actors in Wales will be investing in their future within Europe and within the wider world as well.
Jo Hunt, Rachel Minter, thank you for your time.
The First Minister's statement about the Welsh Government's paper Brexit and Devolution can be heard in full in the previous episode of Golai. For the remainder of this episode, we've included the Q&A session that followed that statement. I'm afraid that the sound isn't fantastic, but the First Minister made some very interesting responses to the questions he was asked, so we've included it anyway.
Thanks very much. We now have some time for questions to the First Minister. I wonder if I might abuse my position as the chair just by starting with one of my own. Obviously, this document obviously covers some very big issues, and therefore, First Minister raises a lot of important questions. I wonder if I might just talk about directly, you talk on page 12 of this document about if we can't reach a satisfactory arrangement with the UK government, bringing forward legislation within the Assembly to protect the Welsh devolution settlement. How would that work, do you think?
It would be a continuity bill that would secure the powers that the Assembly already has and would make it very clear that when powers return from Brussels, that they would come to us. It's important just to say once again that our view is that in devolved areas, when powers return, they bypass London. They don't go to London first, then come to us. So if we look at agriculture, we look at fisheries, for example, they would come straight to us. And the continuity bill would go some way towards making sure that if the UK government wanted to change that position, it would need legislation to do it. It has no mandate to do that. I'm sure the House of Lords would have a view on that.
Yes, I mean, the Secretary of State said sometime before the election that the UK government would take these powers and put them in a holding pattern. That's clearly not your view, I guess.
No. I can see the sense in the four governments agreeing not to effect change in the early stages of those powers coming back. I can understand that in order to create stability. But there are two approaches that can be taken here. The first one is to say everything sits in London until London decides what it wants to give out, which is not an approach that we favour. Or we can all say, OK, when it comes to areas like farming and fisheries, there is a need for some commonality between the four governments, but let's agree on that. What is agreed is owned by four. What is dictated is only owned by one. And that means that, for example, if we felt that things were being imposed on us, we would resist that. That's not what I want. You know, I don't want to be in a position where we have an ongoing battle with the UK government over what is and what isn't devolved. I'd much rather we said, OK, let's put the structure in place now where we can all agree.
Any questions? First of all, Rachel, please.
I was curious to hear a little bit more about your ideas around the Council of Ministers. So what you imagine the shape of this would be and how this contrasts with the Cross Nations Forum that we have at the moment.
Well, the JMC is a talking shop. Sometimes it becomes a shouting match. Now, that's not really what we need. What we need is something closer to the Council of Ministers that exists at EU level, or something that's more manageable with only four members of that. Let's take, for example, animal health. Now, on the island of Great Britain, it's one area in terms of animal health, but we all have different responsibilities with animal health. It makes no sense to have three different policies on animal health on one island. So We need a way in which we can agree a common approach, for example, in that area. Fisheries, hugely difficult area because we have to work out who is able to fish where and with what size boats and in whose waters. Now that needs to be resolved through an intergovernmental mechanism, not by imposition. If the UK government wanted, for example, to impose its will in terms of those areas, well, we would resist that. And if we resisted that, they would have no way of enforcing those rules. Now that leads to my mind, to chaos. Much better than to have a situation where we have an agreed structure. If we have agreed the rules, then we own those rules. We've got no complaint. We can't say, sorry, we don't agree with those rules. So if we've agreed them, we own them. But also what's important is that we have an independent mechanism of policing those rules. At the moment, if we have a dispute with the UK Treasury, the dispute is resolved by the UK Treasury. So actually, there's no independent mechanism to resolve disputes. That has to change. Every single market has a court that acts as the interpreter and adjudicator of those rules. The US Supreme Court does it for interstate commerce in the US. The European Court of Justice does it for the internal single market of the EU. We need to have a court performing that role within the internal single market of the UK. It could be the Supreme Court. None of this is difficult. You know, all this can be put in place long before we leave. And will ensure that we have the stability that we need for the future, but also ensure that devolution is respected, because the UK had one government in 1973, it's got four now.
First Minister, do you sense that there is in London a willingness to think this sort of radically about the, you know, restructuring the UK, introducing this form of sort of shared rule, genuine shared rule between the governments, would be a very radical step for the UK? Is Whitehall willing to do this, do you think?
I think it's more willing now than it was last Thursday. Put it that way. Last week, no, I didn't detect that at all. Look, for many years we've had this concept of parliamentary sovereignty. I don't buy that anymore, I'm afraid.
I don't see why it is that there should be one institution that effectively is the font of all power in the UK, namely Westminster, and it's Westminster's role to dole out power as it sees fit, which is the current constitutional position. For me, we should move to a situation of shared sovereignty. Is that radical? No, Canada does it. Canada is a stable country. There's sovereignty is shared there between the provinces and the federal government. There's no reason why it can't happen here without creating instability. So yes, it does mean moving away from the concept of parliamentary sovereignty, but that journey began in 1997.
Yeah. Do you think there might also, though, be some problems from the other direction, in the sense that, you know, rebuilding the UK along this model would also, I suppose, require the agreement of, you know, a Scottish government that doesn't fundamentally believe in the UK. And when we have a Northern Irish executive, you know, about half of that doesn't really fundamentally believe in the UK either.
Well, I mean, it's the Scots and Northern Ireland can speak for themselves. I mean, they've taken part in the JMC. The two major parties in Northern Ireland have played a full part in the JMC. The SNP government of Scotland has played a full part, even though the direction of travel for Sinn Féin and for the SNP in terms of the final destination is different to other parties. That needn't stop governments working together to reform the structure of the UK now, whatever their view is as to whether they want to be part of the UK in the future.
Open up to further questions.
Thank you. Lorna Gwilym from the Welsh Local Government Association. Really welcome the references to subsidiarity, in particular about devolving powers down to the most appropriate level. I just want to emphasise the key role of local government. At the moment, we're implementing somewhere between 60 and 70% of European legislation. So just to emphasise, I'm keen to work with you and your officials going forward to develop the right models going forward.
No, indeed, I support subsidiarity. I support powers being given to the level of government that's closest to people, as long as that's appropriate. So, for example, with town and community councils, in the long term, I'd like to see them get more powers as well. But the reality is, not every town and community council can have the same powers because they vary so wildly in size. And I'm acutely aware of the fact that I've argued for years about the devolution of power from Westminster. I can't then argue against the devolution of power to local authorities, where those powers would sit properly with local authorities.
David Hughes, head of the European Commission Office in Wales, following all this with great interest, obviously. I haven't had time to read this yet, First Minister, but you've said several times, and I'm sure it says here somewhere, that the clock is ticking right here since Article 50 was notified. But in your letter to the Prime Minister on Tuesday, you referred to the extreme tightness of the schedule, and you said more or less clearly that there isn't time to negotiate a withdrawal agreement and a new relationship. And you said that it was time to come together and argue about the form of transitional arrangements to give a little more time for that. I wonder whether you would be able to share any thoughts you might have on what form those transitional arrangements could take today.
Yeah, I mean, I don't believe for 1 minute there will be an agreement in place by March 2019. It's impossible. The timescale isn't even 2 years, as you'll know, David. The reality is that not a great deal will happen before September, when the German elections are over. In reality, those discussions would need to be concluded by next autumn, next year, because it would take 6 months to ratify any agreement through the national and regional parliaments of the EU and the EU itself. So that's, I mean, and I've spoken to people who've been involved in negotiating trade agreements, and they all say, well, it takes a year and a half to actually talk about what you're going to talk about, to agree what the discussions are going to be about. It takes 7 years to actually put an agreement in place. So in terms of a transitional arrangement, for me, it would involve something close to EEA membership for now. There is the option of looking again at EFTA, although the EFTA countries, you know, have a sense of reluctance about the UK coming into EFTA because of its size compared to the other three. And I think it's perfectly acceptable to look at these things as a transition. I suspect the transitional arrangements will take years before we get to a position where there is a mutually beneficial relationship between the UK and the EU that's stable, but it's just not going to happen by March 2019. I was in Norway in January. The Norwegian model is interesting. It's not quite a fit, as far as we are concerned. Norway has access to the single market, except for agriculture and fisheries. They have their own reasons why they don't want that either in terms of fisheries. They avoid, of course, most of the tariffs. And believe you me, if you look, the number of tariffs that exist, there are tariffs on hats, on umbrellas. You know, who would have sat down and thought through these tariffs years ago in the WTO, I don't know. In order to access that single market, Norway does two things. It acknowledges the jurisdiction of the ECJ. And secondly, of course, it has a slightly different model of freedom of movement that is in that is within the EU's rules, but it is not as liberal as it is in the UK. So in other words, you can go to Norway if you've got a job, and there's a three-month window either side if you're looking for a job, or if you've lost a job to look for another one, and then you have to leave. On that basis, Norway has access to the single market, not membership. And one of the things that I've noticed is that the terminology is used loosely by many people. I've seen it over the last few days. Membership of the single market involves being a member of the EU. Because if you're a member of something, you have a say in the rules that govern that organisation. So you can only do that if you're a member of the EU. Access to the single market is something different. In other words, you're able to sell into that market, but you accept, not being a member of it, that you can control its rules. Well, that's what the UK voted for last year. It voted that it didn't want to have a say in the rules under which the single market was governed. So they are two different things. Access to and membership of are different concepts.
Nick Sweeney.
Have you had any response from the Scottish Government in terms of your proposals for the Joint Ministerial Council?
Not as yet. I know that Mark Drakeford had a conversation with Mike Russell, I think it was yesterday, where the issue was touched on, and the Scots have no difficulty, I understand, with the letter, and they understand the thrust of it. But no, I mean, it's been early for a formal response from Scotland, so I wouldn't expect that now, but there have been some informal discussions.
Can I summit online for people to go a convention consult the adult in travel and a papa yma. Sy'n meddwl bydd yn gweithio? Pa fath o model ydych chi'n ystyried? Dwi wedi siarad heddi am cadair yn y bynnol, ond pwy bydd aelodau commission? Pwy bydd yn cymryd ran and gwaith y commission, bydd y South Wadfraith, bydd yn cael rhywbeth fel commission brenhinol, Kilbrandon yr enghraifft, ni wedi cael y blaen. Pa fath o convention dy chi'n dygmygu?
Well, commission brenhinol na, os bydd y commission brenhinol rhywbeth sydd yn ffynhoni o San Steffan, ond mae rhaid i'r commission i gael ei adeiladu ar sylfaen sy'n fwy eang yna. Yeah. So i fi, bydde hwn yn rhywbeth i'r JMC, a wedi ta beth bydde'n dod ar ôl y JMC i ystyried. Ni gyd i ddod at yn gilydd i gweud, hwn felly bydd y broses. Ni'n mynd i gytuno ar ynglyn â pwy bydd y cadeirydd, cytuno ynglyn â pwy bydd ar y comisiwn, a wedyn sicrhau bod y comisiwn yn mynd mas a siarad y bobl. Mae yna fodel yna ynglyn â'r comisiwn cyfansoddi ar olgeithio nhw'n yr Alban. Dwi'n meddwl bod y model hynny yn berffaith i'r broses hyn, ond i fi, na fel bydd fi'n gweithio. Peth gweitha i fi, byddai rhyw fath o gyfensiwn sydd yn cael ei sefydlu gan San Steffan a sydd yn gil ynglyn â'r nifer o bobl a bydd y gyfensiwn hynny yn siarad gyda. So i fi, mae hwn yn dechrau yn y JMC a wedyn ni y cof sydd yn dod ar ôl hynny lle byddwn ni'n eistedd lawr fel pedwar llywodraeth a chytuno ar beth fydd y gyfensiwn yn edrych arno a wedyn ni wrth gwrs aelodaeth y gyfensiwn.
Diolch. Any more questions? Any more questions? Right. Well, if we don't have any more questions, then...
All the answers are in there.
Yeah. Yes. We do one more. Yeah, please. Okay, fine.
First of all, thank you for that. Helen Bertelsel from Wales for Europe. Can we now, do you think, time today, by the way, is impeccable, I think, for this event you've launched today. Have we now got grounds for more hope and optimism for the future of Wales, our relationship with Europe, and our relationships with the rest of the UK?
I think as far as the UK, well, yes. Just to answer the question first of all, why do I say that? Because I think the election last week changed everything. I think before the election last week, we were headed towards a Brexit that was dogmatic, nationalist, a Brexit that was based on the world will come to us, we don't need to reach out to the world. And that worried me, because I know that's not right, because the world doesn't care that much. And it's hugely important we see this as a two-way process. The election, I think, has killed off the idea of a hard Brexit. I think there's much more of an understanding, well, the mood music we're getting from Whitehall has changed. There's much more of an understanding that Brexit has to be good for people, good for business, that it maintains our links as strongly as possible with the rest of the EU. There are some thorny questions yet to be answered. The first one needs to be, the first question to be asked in my mind is the question of mutual recognition of residence for citizens. I think that's got to be dealt with first. And before, actually, the substantive discussions. I think giving comfort to people is by far the most important thing to do at the beginning. The question of Ireland is insoluble, as far as I can tell at the moment, because how can you have, you know, we hear hard Brexiteers saying we want to control our borders, or except for the land border that we have with Ireland. The problem is that I know, having spoken to some of them, that they thought the EU would collapse after Brexit. It's not happening. The danger, in fact, is that the EU will be more united than ever, but against us. And they also thought that Ireland would leave as well. Or the best one of all, one of them said to me, well, I'm sure the Irish would accept British Border Agency officials in their ports and airports. Yeah, right. Being married to somebody Irish, I can tell you what the answer would have been to that in one word, which is not really broadcastable this time of the morning. And so that is unresolved. Now, in many ways, that's not for us. You know, what is our interest in Wales and the border between the north and south of Ireland? Well, we have an indirect interest in making sure that peace continues. That much is true. But we have an interest in terms of our own maritime border with the Republic of Ireland. If the border between north and south is seamless, I've got no problem with that, but the border between Wales and Ireland, the maritime border, is not so seamless. In other words, there are customs checks, customs forms to be filled in, possibly border control. Then the incentive for trade, and for the freight operators particularly, would be to avoid the Welsh ports. Go through Cairn Ryan in Scotland, go through Liverpool and go to Northern Ireland, then down, rather than mess about in Holyhead, Fishguard and Pembroke. So there are job losses there if we're not careful. In fact, the Irish government has realised this, and you know, we're working with them on how that could work. But I think there are now many more options available in terms of Brexit. I have to say, I've said this from the very beginning, a second referendum is not on the table for me. I think if you advocate a second referendum so soon after the first one, you get punished. And I think that's an element of what happened in Scotland last week as well. But I have always said that any deal should be ratified by the four parliaments, not just by one. Because, you know, this affects areas that are wholly devolved, like agriculture, like fisheries. But also, you know, potentially in the future, it establishes the precedent that there needs to be involvement beyond Westminster. If you look at trade is not devolved. But if the UK concludes a free trade agreement with New Zealand that allows the free flow of lamb into the UK, that just pretty much destroys Welsh farming. It was not devolved, but we have a very strong interest in it. So it is massively important that we establish the principle now that with Brexit and post-Brexit, that it's not just for Westminster.
Very quick question, actually, a very quick answer. Have you had a reply to you yet?
Not yet. No, I've been stunned to have a reply that quickly. Usually it takes months. So, I've been told informally that the letter's been considered carefully.
And are we expecting anything before the starts of negotiations next week?
Well, who knows? I mean, we haven't had a formal response to our white paper. Although I have been told that they believe that the fact they'd incorporated our white paper into much of what they were saying, that was a kind of response. Whitehall doesn't work quickly, and I wouldn't expect a response by now. I mean, the letter is a substantive letter. If I had a response this quickly, it might be an indication that full consideration has been given to it. So I'm not looking for a response this week.
Right. I think the only thing that remains is for me to say a few words of thank you. First of all, to all of you, our audience here this morning, for coming along and providing a number of very interesting, perceptive questions. Secondly, to our hosts here at Cardiff University Business School, who've helped us put together this event at quite short notice very well. Thirdly, to the officials in the Welsh Government and my colleagues in the Welsh Government Centre, who've done a lot of the legwork as well in pulling together this event. And finally, to the First Minister. Today's document, Brexit and Devolution, I think is a really important contribution to the debates, not just affecting Wales interests, but all of the people in these islands. There were an awful lot of questions, as the First Minister was saying, which are going to need a great deal of consideration, but this is a very important contribution to some very serious and consequential debates. Firstly, Diolch yn fawr iawn.
Thanks for listening to Golau, a Cardiff University podcast. Subscribe in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from to have the next episode download automatically.